Lecture 4. Study.
Welcome back to Lecture 4 of the Introduction to Judaism course, which is on Talmud Torah, or studying, learning. Actually, the definition of Talmud Torah is very cute, because Talmud means learning or studying, and Torah means teaching. So Talmud Torah could be translated as learning teaching, right? But it's the idea of study. And it turns out to be the central commandment, or mitzvah, in Rabbinic Judaism. We already have the idea within the Torah itself, within the Pentateuch itself, of speaking about these words day and night. That is familiar to some Jews because it is enshrined in the liturgy of the Shema. Shema comes from the first word of Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel. Shema means listen up, hearken. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord our God with all of our heart, soul, and it should probably be translated as property. It's usually translated as might. And you shall speak about these words, probably referring back to the Decalogue that had been given in Deuteronomy chapter 5. But rabbinic tradition accepts those words as all of the Torah. You shall speak about those words all the time when you're walking along the way, when you're sitting in your house, when you lie down at night, when you rise up in the morning. So the idea of speaking of the words, the going over the repetition of God's words or God's ways, God's mitzvot, the plural of mitzvah, God's commandments, is already enshrined in the Torah itself, at least according to the rabbinic rereading of the Torah. We also have Psalm 119, which is a paean to the idea of loving Torah, of talking about Torah all the time. What do we have here from verse 97 to 98? Psalm 119 is a very long psalm. Oh, how I love your teaching. Teaching is Torah. Oh, how I love your teaching. It is my study all day long. Your commandments make me wiser than my enemies. They always stand by me. They always stand by me. So all of Psalm 119, all 100 and however many verses it is, it's actually the an acrostic. The Hebrew alphabet has 22 letters, and it repeats that Hebrew alphabet 4 times, going A through Z or Aleph through Taf, 4 times, and so you've got this big, long psalm that's all about how wonderful the Torah is. So even within the Tanakh itself, the Torah and studying the Torah, relating to it as a source of wisdom and commandments to guide your life, are promoted. By the time we get to the rabbinic period, after the temple has been destroyed, the value of Talmud Torah shoots up because so many other values sort of drop off the radar screen, because once the temple has been destroyed, all of those priestly functions are no longer obtainable, and anything that you would do in the temple, you can no longer do. So the value of studying the Torah as a way of communing with God and knowing the divine mind is characteristic of Rabbinic Judaism. One of the statements that gets at the centrality of Talmud Torah is by Shimon the Righteous, Shimon HaTzadik, who says that the world stands on 3 things: on Torah, on worship, and on acts of loving kindness. So I took that statement by Shimon the Righteous for this lecture and our next 2 lectures. So this lecture is dedicated to the world standing on Torah. Now, does he mean that the world really stands, that the world is resting on a pillar, a tripod, and that one leg of that tripod is Torah? And if people were to stop studying Torah, then the world could no longer be held up or maintained? I think there's a sense in which he does mean that. We have a rabbinic statement that says, without Torah, the world would sink back into the watery chaos of the beginning. The watery chaos of the beginning. Right? The first verses of the Hebrew Bible in the King James translation say something like, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth looked like this. The earth was formless and void. The idea, the picture that you get from the King James translation is when the curtain goes up on the stage of creation, the stage is black. There's nothing there. boom, God creates heaven and earth, and heaven and earth are in this inchoate, incipient form, and God orders the creation. God takes chaos and moves it towards cosmos, chaos to order. But the Hebrew suggests something else, and so the New Jewish Publication Society translation of the Tanakh has as follows. When God began creating the heavens and the earth was formless and void. What's the difference? When the curtain goes up on the screen of creation there, on the stage of creation, what you're seeing is this kind of watery, chaotic swirl already there, and God takes those elements that existed before the curtain went up and orders that. So what the rabbis here are saying, and the rabbis were okay with that idea, that God took pre-existent matter and made a kind of divine order out of that pre-existent chaos. By the time we get to the Middle Ages, they have problems with that idea. But the rabbis in the rabbinic period from the first century to the seventh century say they were fine with that idea. But what they say about Torah is that without Torah, the world would revert to this watery primeval chaos. I think the idea there is actually fairly easy to understand, namely that without laws to govern our society, we would revert to a state of nature that the rabbis understand, much like Thomas Hobbes understood, was nasty, short, and brutish, and that things would become complete anarchy and complete chaos without the laws that the Torah gives us to organize our societies and our lives. It's more, though, Talmud Torah, than about ordering your life. It's also where to find God, God's exclusive address. In the post-temple reality, divine access is now available only through the study of God's Word. For my undergraduates, I do a little skit called Theography. Theography, my wife doesn't like the term because she thinks it should be about theology and writing. Graphy, but the way I'm using the term theography, it's about theology and geography. So the question is where to find God. If you think about the early books of the Hebrew Bible in this theographic skit that I'm going to now lay out for you, the way you find God, the place you find God is in nature, walking through the Garden of Eden in the breezy time of the day, and in history. God appears to Abraham. God appears to Moses in the form of a burning bush, right? That's where you encounter God in this world, in nature or in history. God leads the Israelites out of Egypt with a strong hand. By the time we get into the middle books of the Hebrew Bible, God's presence is accessed no longer in nature and history, but in the tabernacle, which then becomes the prototype for the temple in Jerusalem. So once we get into the land of Israel, the place that you go to access the divine presence is the temple in Jerusalem. Once the temple is destroyed, where do you go to get God's presence? How do you access that? So the rabbinic answer was the closest thing to God that we have is God's will as represented in the Torah, in the five books of Moses. And what is so nice about the Torah is that God can be accessed through the Torah 24/7. It's not like you need a priestly intermediary anymore at the temple to get to God. Anybody in this kind of democratization of piety, anyone can access the Torah. Moreover, it doesn't matter who your mama was or who your daddy was. In order to be a priest, you had to be of the priestly line, which was one of Aaron's grandsons, okay, Phinehas or Pinchas. In order to have that position of power and prestige and influence in the community, it was pedigree. But now anyone in this move toward democratization who has the intellectual power of mastering the traditions of the Torah, they can establish themselves as the pious, as the leaders, and also as the ones that represent a kind of purity, both in terms of ritual purity that the Pharisees emphasized and moral purity that the rabbis emphasized. So we see this democratization process of the leadership in the Jewish community as a result of the destruction of the temple, right? Some Jews say, Thank God the Romans destroyed the temple because it allowed rabbinic Judaism to emerge in ways that are much more in keeping with modern Jewish sensibilities of a more egalitarian access. Women could study Torah, but we don't have too many. We have a few, but we don't have too many examples in rabbinic history of women actually being literate at all or mastering the traditions of the Torah. One statement by the rabbis in the Talmud is as follows. Rabbi Chiya bar Ami, the son of Ami, said, "Since the day the temple was destroyed, the Holy One has in this world nothing other than the 4 cubits, or arm lengths, of the halakha, of Jewish law." In other words, you access God, now that the temple's destroyed, you access God through the halakha. I view this statement, personally, as sad, that the way you access God is through Jewish law. And there were people that disagreed with that statement when it was said in the rabbinic period, and there were movements in Judaism in the Middle Ages and in the early modern period and in the modern period that were dedicated to finding God outside of the halakha as well. But we see that one prominent posture of how to get to God is through not just Torah and all the stories that we have, but the halakha, through Jewish law. So Talmud Torah is a function of intelligence and discipline that's open to everyone, and some of the rabbis, anyway, emphasized the halachic, or the legal aspects of Torah, as the way to commune with God and translate God's will into the realities of the present political and social structure of the Jewish community. Now, there's also an aspect of Talmud Torah that is very erotic. And many rabbis talk about wishing they had 2 mouths so that they could talk Torah all day long with one mouth, and then with the other mouth, when they needed to conduct their business affairs, their private affairs, their personal affairs, they would still have access to that. There's something about Talmud Torah, and I speak from personal experience here, having been in the yeshiva world for a few years in Jerusalem, in the world of Jewish seminary, there's something that's addicting and obsessive about it, where once you get into this mode, into this, not rut, but into this groove of studying Torah, you just want to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it at the exclusion of all the other things that we should be doing, that rabbinic Judaism commands us to be doing. So we know that this was a problem for the early rabbis because so many rabbinic statements are dedicated to saying, don't neglect your other responsibilities. Well, they wouldn't need to say, don't neglect your other responsibilities, unless people were neglecting their other responsibilities. So, for instance, there's a statement in Perkei Avot, which is part of the Mishnah. It's an appendix of the Mishnah, which we'll talk about in the next section, that says Talmud Torah should be combined with worldly concerns. And that someone that just does study, but doesn't translate that into practice, it's as if they have no God. Harsh words. The rabbis were very hyperbolic. They used exaggeration whenever they wrote agadic statements. Agadah. We talked about halakha as Jewish law. Agadah is everything else. Agadah literally means telling or recounting. And the agadic sections of rabbinic literature could deal with theology or folklores or magic, what we would call superstition, stories about the rabbis and the disciples. Anything that doesn't specifically have to do with the Jewish law is called Agadah. And in the Agadah, the rabbis were very freewheeling about, you know, someone that just studies Torah and doesn't engage in worldly pursuits is as if they have no gods. Right? Very dramatic and bold in their language. So there was this kind of passionate love affair that many of the rabbis had to the Torah, and they had to be reminded not to neglect worldly concerns. But there was also a sense that the goal of Talmud Torah wasn't just to commune with God, but should also be transformative. There's a lovely passage that says that the Torah has 613 commandments. We mentioned that number, 613. Which is divided into 365 negative commandments. You shall not commit murder, you shall not commit adultery, and 248 positive commandments. remember the Sabbath day, eat matzah, unleavened bread on Passover. And in the Talmud itself, it links those numbers, 365 and 248, to the 365 days of a solar year and the 248 parts of a human body. Now, there are about 365 days in a solar year. I've asked my medical friends if they know of the number 248, and they said that, you know, that's a stretch. But the idea behind the Midrash of 365 days and 248 parts of the body is that what studying Torah should be is this transformative experience of making our entire body reflect the will of God all the time, every moment of every day. We should be walking Torahs with our entire body all of the time. This may be, and I say this speculatively, this may be a little bit of a polemic with Christianity, where in Christianity, you've got Jesus, who is the embodiment of God, one person. Whereas the ideal for Rabbinic Judaism is that all Jews, all Rabbinic Jews, should not be the embodiment of God, but the embodiment of God's will as expressed through the Torah. Okay. Now we're going to move from talking about the centrality and importance of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah to a brief description of some of the books on the rabbinic bookshelf. Again, rabbinic literature, let's push it way back. The sources for rabbinic literature may start in the first or even second century BCE and probably go till the 7th, 8th century of the Common Era. The books themselves begin in the 3rd century, but a 3rd century book that was redacted and edited, and it didn't really have two covers, but it was sealed, it has a beginning and an end, a 3rd century book may have traditions that are several centuries older than the book itself. The first literary production of rabbinic Judaism that I want to talk about is the Mishnah. The Mishnah literally means repetition, because you repeat, when you learn something, you do it by repeating it over and over through memorization, right? You have to remember that we're talking about 2,000 years ago when they didn't have computer texts, computers at all, and the process of learning in an oral culture was through the repetition. The Mishnah is a codex of Jewish law that was compiled by Yehuda Hanasi, or Judah the Prince, around the year 220 of the Common Era. Judah the Prince, the person who redacted this text, was the leader both in a religious sense and in a political sense of that community of Jews that was still in the land of Israel. The Mishnah is a codex of Jewish law, and it's not a law book. What's the difference? A law book has the laws. It tells you what to do, X, Y, and Z. What's distinctive about the Mishnah is that it retains minority opinions and dissenting opinions. Every once in a while, it also throws in some stories, but very infrequently. The Mishnah is much more halachic than agadic. Okay? The Mishnah retains these minority opinions and dissenting opinions because it says explicitly that maybe sometime in the future, there may arise a court whose justices are intelligent and of greater intelligence than they are, and of greater number than they are, perhaps, and they'll want to rely on the minority opinions or even on the dissenting opinions. Because as historical circumstances change, sometimes laws also need to change in order to address the needs of that present population. The Mishnah itself is arranged conceptually, unlike the appearance of many of the laws throughout the Torah, so that you've got six orders of the Mishnah. There's a song that is sung after the Passover Seder, One Who Knows, and it goes through 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 13. Apparently, this started out as a wedding song, as a drinking song. And so people would go around the table and say, okay, I've got the number one, there's one God. Okay, the next person has two. Okay, there are two tablets. Right? In the Decalogue, you've got two tablets. And the person that couldn't think of the next number would have to drink. So when they got to six, it was the six orders of the Mishnah. They have to do with sacrificial issues in the temple, purity issues, criminal law, laws related to women, laws related to agriculture, and laws related to the holidays. So those are the six general divisions of the Mishnah. When the laws in the Mishnah are recorded, they're not usually recorded with the biblical verse that justifies the law. So we call this unjustified law. Doesn't mean that there is no reason. It just means that there is no reason that is attached to the Mishnah itself. The Mishnah, it just tells you what to do and what, it tells you what to do, and then it tells you what the other rabbi who disagrees with the first rabbi, which is very common, right, suggests you should do instead. Around 250, there was an appendix to the Mishnah that was put at the end of the fourth division, which was about criminal law, torts. At the very conclusion, you've got this section called Avot, or the fathers, the founders. Abba is father in Hebrew, in Aramaic actually, and Avot in Hebrew is fathers. That section called fathers or founders is exclusively Agadic. That statement that I started with at the beginning, that Shimon the Righteous One said that the world stands on three things, on Torah, on worship, and on acts of loving kindness, that is Agadah found in Pirkei Avot, the chapters of our fathers. That served, Avot served as a kind of introduction to the Mishnah. The Mishnah just presents the laws, but it doesn't give you any justification for the authority of the rabbis to be promoting those laws. So the way that Avot opens up is by saying that Moses received the Torah, and here they mean the oral Torah, what's being included in the Mishnah. So Moses received that Torah at Mount Sinai, and Moses transmitted it to Joshua, and Joshua transmitted it to Pliny, and Pliny transmitted it to Almoni. Right, Joe Schmo, Pliny Almoni is Joe Schmo in Hebrew. And eventually it came down to Shimon the Righteous One, and then to Hillel, who we'll talk about at some point in our lecture, and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, and the rabbis who make up Rabbinic Judaism. So there is an unbroken chain of tradition from Sinai all the way down to rabbinic Jews that provides the authority for their interpretation of the Torah about things that seem to not sit quite so well with a plain sense reading of the Torah, as well as issues that the Torah doesn't even talk about. For instance, the Torah doesn't talk about how to kill an animal according to the laws of keeping kosher or kashrut. So if you need to, right, we know that we're only supposed to eat certain kinds of animals. Well, you have to eat them once they're dead and once the blood has been drained out of them. How do you do it? That information is found in the Mishnah. It fills in the spaces where the Bible doesn't seem to be so interested in giving you, in fleshing out the details. Fleshing out, so to speak. Okay. So the Hebrew Bible is relatively small. The Mishnah is much bigger. Much bigger. And what the function of Pirkei Avot is to link this idea of the oral Torah back to the same source and divine authority as the written Torah in hoary antiquity at Mount Sinai when the Israelites left Egypt. The Mishnah. The Mishnah is that first layer, and it was the curriculum that students who were studying to become masters of the tradition first learned. But in the process of learning the Mishnah, new questions came up. New ways of looking at the law or looking at the text came up. And those conversations about how to understand the Mishnah and why this law is authoritative, and what biblical verse does this law stem from, those conversations were recorded and later edited into what is called the Gemara. The Gemara is an Aramaic word that means learning. Mishnah is a Hebrew word that means learning. Gemara is an Aramaic word, which was the common language of the land of Israel for hundreds and hundreds of years during this period. It also means learning. The Mishnah plus the Gemara equals the Talmud. The Talmud is a big bookshelf of the Mishnah at its base, and then conversations that start about the Mishnah, but then go off in a kind of stream of consciousness way to all kinds of different ideas and different topics. For instance, if we have a law in the Mishnah about how to slit an animal's throat from the front so that it bleeds quickly and not from the back, you can then go, the Gemara might then ask, okay, well, what biblical verse does this come from? So Rabbi Yossi says it comes from the biblical verse such and such. Oh, but Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Okay, and then we'll resolve that problem. And since we introduced Rabbi Yehuda, you know what? Rabbi Yehuda was known for wearing pink and purple on the Sabbath for these reasons. So then we'll go into a whole series of traditions about what these individual rabbis did on the Sabbath that's totally idiosyncratic and has nothing to do with the laws of where to slice an animal's throat in order for kosher butchering. So it's this kind of stream of consciousness, unique literature, and that's part of the reason why it's so engrossing. It pulls you in because you want to know where it's going to go, because you can't ever see around the corner in a Talmudic sugya, or a Talmudic passage. There are two Gemaras. There were two sets of conversations that happened around the Mishnah. One set of conversations happened in the land of Israel, probably in Tiberias and in northern Israel, but that Gemara is called, or that Talmud is called the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. And it's called the Jerusalem Talmud because of the centrality and importance and holiness of Jerusalem to the entire Jewish people. So there's the Jerusalem Talmud, but the more authoritative Talmud for purposes of deciding the halakha was created in Babylonia. After the Great Revolt in 70, there were many Jews that left the land of Israel, and even more so 70 years later. When we talk about Messianism, we're going to talk about the Bar Kokhba Revolt. The Bar Kokhba Revolt happened, it started in 132, about 62 years after the destruction of the Second Temple. Because about 60 years after, there was this notion that just like 70 years after the First Temple had been destroyed, it was rebuilt, so too God will somehow create a situation where 70 years after the Second Temple, the Third Temple will be rebuilt. And so a few rabbis, but one particularly prominent rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, supported Bar Kokhba as a messiah, as the person to militarily lead the Jews against the Roman occupation. Didn't work out so well. And as a result of this failed revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt from 132 to 135, even more Jews left the land of Israel and emigrated to the Jewish community in Babylonia that had been there since the destruction of the first temple and the exile, the Babylonian exile, already back in the 6th century BCE. So there was a long-standing Babylonian community. By the way, it was at that point, during the Bar Kokhba revolt, that the Romans got so fed up with the Jews that they decided to change the name of the land of Israel in Judea to echo the Israelites' ancient enemies, the Philistines. That's how that landmass got the name Palestine. Sidia Palestina was what the Romans called it, just to erase any trace of a Jewish presence and to kind of dig it into the Jews that they were naming it after the biblical Israelites' ancient enemies, the Philistines. So you've got the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. In terms of quantity, my thumbnail represents the amount of quality of the amount of quantity of the Mishnah, and the rest of my wingspan is Gemara. There's much, 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 much more Gemara than there is to the Mishnah. The Mishnah I can hold in my hand. Okay, it's bigger than the Hebrew Bible, but I can still hold it in my hand. I'm not nearly big enough or strong enough to hold the entire Talmud. There's one final genre of literature that typifies what the rabbis were doing in this period, and that is called Midrash. The word Midrash means to seek or inquire. The first person in the Hebrew Bible to engage in this process of seeking or inquiring or drashing is Rebekah, Isaac's wife. Rebekah drashes God, and the rabbis subsequently drash God's word. They no longer can go to the temple or can go to oracles, as perhaps Rebekah did, and go immediately to the source, to God. So the rabbis take this activity and apply it not to God, but to God's text, the Torah. A midrash is an idea linked to a biblical verse. Actually, My own theory is that Midrash also relates to the word to weave. In the last chapter of Proverbs, we have the phrase Darshat Semeru Fishtim, the righteous woman, the wife of valor. She weaves together, or she drashes, wool and flax. And I think what a midrash is weaving the text of the Torah to a current idea that you want to then communicate to your own congregation. Midrashic compilations are usually categorized as either halachic or agadic. The earliest halachic compilations come from the land of Israel in the 3rd century. The agadic compilations also come from the land of Israel, but they're dated to the 5th century. Midrashic compilations, unlike the Mishnah, they're arranged according to the biblical verses upon which they comment. So if you're trying to do a sermon on a particular chapter of the Torah, it's easy to find it in Midrash, because it goes according to what comes before and what comes after in the Tanakh. It's very difficult to find anything in the Mishnah. You have to know conceptually where it falls. We will continue with our next lecture on the second of the tripod of Shimon the Righteous's tripod of the things that the world stands on worship. Thank you.